The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Just like in Hungary, the answer to this is very simple. If the opposition unites, they can win. If they don't, they will definitely lose. The reason the current ruling party is doing what it's doing is that three left-wing parties went into the last election separately. None of them made the threshold. They were excluded from parliament, and that's why 38% of the vote was enough to gain majority of seats in parliament. So you can never exclude political incompetence as an agent of history.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 7th, 2018. It's been a bad week for Polish democracy, with the government removing a bunch of judges from the country's Supreme Court in order to replace them with party loyalists. In response, protesters took to the streets to push back against the deconsolidation of Polish democracy. Joining me to discuss this week's events and the larger degradation of Polish governance that they're a part of is Radek Sikorski. Radek served as foreign minister and defense minister of Poland, speaker of the Polish parliament, and he ran for president some time back. He has also been a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and he's currently a senior fellow at the Center for European Studies at Harvard University, as well as a distinguished statesman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 327, Radek Sikorski on the week's events in Poland. Radek, let's start with what happened this week in Poland and how it situates in the larger decay of democratic governance in Poland.
What's happened in the last few days is that the president of Poland has sent the head of the Supreme Court a letter saying that she's been retired. And this is odd because she was only appointed 4 years ago, whereas the Constitution explicitly says that the term of office of the chairman of the Supreme Court is 6 years. The government's argument is that you can't be the chairman if you're not a judge, and you're not a judge once you've been retired. But it seems to go directly against a specific article of the Constitution.
And which article is that? And what would be the normal expectation of the tenure of a Supreme Court justice in Poland?
The whole law, which is forcing several Supreme Court judges into retirement at 65, is questionable because arguably senior judges like that should be very experienced senior people. And as far as I know, in your country, judges work until much later. So 65 seems a very arbitrary thing to do. And the government is pretty explicit about it. They say they want to get rid of judges who spent even a few years of their early careers in the 1980s, which is to say in the last decade of communism. That seems to be very radical. And it looks like a political purge.
You say it looks like a political purge. Is that the objective here, or is there some construction of it that is more generous than that?
The person actually leading the country now is Jarosław Kaczyński, the chairman of the ruling party, Law and Justice, the twin brother of the deceased former president of Poland who died in the Smolensk crash. And he has said very explicitly that he wants to purge Polish elites, which he regards as corrupt and having roots in post-communism. And this has been done very thoroughly. One of the first things the new government did was to abolish the civil service, which is to say abolish competitive examinations to be civil servants. And about 10,000 people in the army, in diplomacy, in the prosecution service, in security services, and in state-owned companies have so far been expelled, replaced by party loyalists.
Talk about the reaction to the move against the Supreme Court. There have been significant street protests. People seem to be reacting to this in as something beyond what the Law and Justice Kaczyński movement has sought to do before. How big an escalation is this in your estimation?
There were these protests before because there were instances of breaking the constitution before. One of the first things the new government did was to pack against the rules the constitutional court, which is a separate institution in Poland. And it's now staffed with party loyalists, which means that Poland doesn't have judicial review of legislation. That you can, in effect, change the constitution by an ordinary bill because the constitutional court will just say it's okay. And then the justice minister gave himself the right to appoint court presidents. He also became the chief prosecutor, which wasn't the case under the previous government. The chief prosecutor was an independent, non-political figure. The assault on the Supreme Court is seen as the completion of the process of subjugating the judiciary. And it's particularly egregious because the Supreme Court and its president have two specific functions. Number one, they pronounce the legality of a general election. And also the president of the Supreme Court is the president of the state tribunal before you can try politicians who've broken the constitution. So if you replace that person with a party loyalist, you are getting two further important political leverages.
The country that everybody compares Poland's situation to these days is Hungary. I'm interested in your reflections on that comparison. Is the situation in Poland as bad as under Orban in Hungary, or is it sort of ineluctably on that road, or are there opportunities available to arrest the sort of democratic decline that we're seeing?
The similarities are not accidental because Chairman Kaczyński regularly meets Viktor Orban and studies his playbook. And so, for example, this trick of retiring Supreme Court judges was done in Hungary too. It's happening faster in Poland, and the difference is that the Hungarian ruling party, Fidesz, has actually more support. So it was able to change the constitution legally, whereas in Poland, the ruling party got 38% of the vote, which normally doesn't even give you control of parliament and therefore the right to form the government without a coalition partner. This has happened by a fluke. And it certainly doesn't give you the right to change the constitution. So the constitution, instead of being changed, is being broken.
But that would imply that the situation is not stable, as in, eventually Kaczynski and his party will have to face the electorate. At what point do people have a real opportunity to weigh in on all of this electorally?
And to what extent do they care about these abstruse issues? We shall see. We have an election marathon kicking in this autumn. Regional elections, which are important because we now suspect the opinion polls are not accurate anymore either, because there's a little bit of low-level fear in Poland. It is assumed that these elections will still be honest in the sense of the counting of votes. The democratic ecosystem has been spoiled. For example, Poland's public media are completely under the thumb of the ruling party. Imagine if NPR was taken over by Breitbart, and you get the picture. But we have regional elections this fall, then European elections in the spring, parliamentary elections in the fall of 1919, and then presidentials in the spring of 2020. So quite an electoral marathon. And the ruling party is already changing the electoral law to suit its purposes.
You said there's a certain level of low-grade fear. Talk about that. What is the... I mean, you're a former senior minister in prior Polish governments. What is the atmosphere that as affects both ordinary people, but also, you know, opposition political figures?
Several opposition politicians have been charged, and in some cases, the charges don't look convincing. But what I think is more significant is that about 1,000 people have been charged with petty crimes to do with demonstrating against the government. So you step with one foot over the limit of the demo, or you use one swear word, or you shout at a policeman, or you do something petty like that, and you are charged, which never was the case before in Poland. And so, you know, a lot of people are being harassed, and I think the hope of the authorities is that others will be deterred.
You know, a lot of people make the comparison between, including, you know, our mutual friend David Frum, between the Trump movement and Viktor Orban and Kaczynski. To what extent do those parallels have salience for you when you look at the populist movements in this country right now versus the populist movements of Eastern Europe? To what extent do you buy the kind of, there's a sort of global authoritarian populist thing going on, and to what extent does it seem more regionally specific to you than that?
I think it's a populist wave that's sweeping the entire Western world. If you look at what they say and what they do, they have things in common. Their leaders claim that they represent not the actual nation composed of citizens, but a metaphysical nation that whose will the leader alone is capable of interpreting. Opponents are not competitors, are evil to be eliminated, really. Simple solutions are presented to complex problems. And all of these movements actively seek out enemies, both foreign and domestic ones. They are, to my mind, and I don't mean it as an insult, but as a description, national socialists. National in cultural terms, socialist in economic terms. And that seems to be a very powerful combination. It worked to mobilize people before. But of course, we know with what consequences.
Radek, you were, if my memory serves, a student in the UK at the time of the Solidarity Uprising in the early 80s. You stayed there for a long time. You came back as part of the democratization of Poland. I'm interested in your emotional reaction to all of this. It's an incredible degradation of the governance society that you helped build. And it must also be very scary. What does it look like from the ground there, you know, from the ground of the governance of an emergent democracy that is, turns out to be less consolidated democratically than we all seem to understand?
You know, Ben, I spent 6 weeks in Tora Bora when it was our Mujahideen base against the Soviets under Soviet bombing. So this is not very scary by comparison. It is disappointing because I worked so many years, 14 years in the government, to make Poland a more significant country, a more respected country, and none of them now gives us any good press or any influence in the world. But, you know, on the other hand, I thought that we really were at the end of history, that democracy had triumphed and that my sons will have nothing to fight for. And it appears that they will. And, you know, in Poland, I would just like to reassure you and those who know us from the past that we've overcome bigger challenges than this, and we've brought down worse regimes than this.
Your hail fellow well-met optimism is much appreciated. So I'm interested in your plans in all of this. You know, you have run for president of Poland in the past. You've been foreign minister, defense minister. What is the opposition landscape like from your point of view right now? And do you see yourself playing a future role in it?
Well, just like in Hungary, the answer to this is very simple. If the opposition unites, they can win. If they don't, they will definitely lose. The reason the current ruling party is doing what it's doing is that three left-wing parties went into the last election separately. None of them made the threshold. They were excluded from parliament, and that's why 38% of the vote was enough to gain majority of seats in parliament. So you can never exclude political incompetence as an agent of history. And I just hope my fellow politicians have drawn the lessons. I wish them luck, and I hope I won't have to help them personally because I would only do it in extremis.
Is there, I mean, I have argued domestically in the United States context that we need to put aside traditional left-right differences, which, of course, in the United States is hard because it is a two-party system, which, you know, tends to accentuate left-right differences. But my understanding of the Polish political landscape is that the parties are more fractured, and which both creates the problem that you just described, but also a little bit more opportunity for a united opposition in the event that people perceive enough joint sense of threat. Do you see much basis for optimism about sort of left-right unity in opposition, or realistically, is this going to be a left opposition to the Law and Justice Party?
Yes, I do. There is already a citizens' coalition, which is conscious of the fact that if this authoritarian drift is not is stopped, then Poland will become a bigger and bigger problem as a member of the European Union. It will civilizationally move towards the kind of system that we have in Putin's Russia. And at a time when American involvement in European affairs can no longer be taken for granted, and when the European Union is grappling with several challenges at the same time, Poland should be doing its best to stabilize Europe, not to add to its problems. And I think Polish politicians realize this now.
Talk about the role of Europe. Europe did nothing to stop the drift of Hungary. On the other hand, the lesson of Hungary may have concentrated some minds in Europe and caused people to look at law and justice a little bit differently than they would have had they not had the example of Fidesz before them. Is the European Union playing a constructive role here, and could it be doing more, and what would more look like if it were doing it?
This is very difficult because on the one hand, the European Union is based on member states trusting one another's institutions. So, for example, if a court in one member state issues a European arrest warrant, a court in another member state needs to be confident that this was not a political act, but an act of justice. So a member state that breaches the division of powers or politicizes its judiciary is an actual threat to the European Union, to its legal and integrity. So the European Union has no choice but to get involved. On the other hand, the European Union is a confederation. We agree certain rules in the shape of treaties, and we create joint institutions, but ultimate sovereignty lies in the member states. So there is no higher authority that can bring a member state to book when member states break the rules. And this, in fact, is the original reason why we had first the Eurozone crisis and then the migration Schengen crisis. Member states were cheating on their obligations. I guess the ultimate act of disobedience would be to not respect the judgment of the European Court of Justice. A member state that did that would exclude itself from the Union. And there is now a possibility that Poland will actually be sued by the Commission in the European Court of Justice.
What would the suit be over, and what would be the prospects of the of Poland not abiding by the judgment?
Poland is under review on two counts, the constitutionality or otherwise of the law to retire the judges. And the Venice Commission, which is to say the Council of Europe, has also heavily criticized general state of rule of law in Poland. And on that count, Poland is under review and is potentially threatened with having its vote suspended in the European Union. So there are two parallel processes.
Radek Sikorski, thank you so much for joining us, and keep up the struggle.
Thank you. My pleasure.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Radek for joining me on short notice from Warsaw. Our music is, as it always is, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. If you are not doing your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast, shame on you. Get on it. Tweet us, share us on Facebook, and of course, leave us a review on whatever podcast distribution service you use. Our audio engineer this week is Matthew Kahn. The Lawfare Podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell. And as always, thanks for listening.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.